back to another episode of The Ink Drop. I am your host, Matthew McGebna. Just popping in for a little rant. I'm solo today. I've been doing a craft series with some writers, and I'm still kind of working on that. I have three currently up right now on this podcast, and I have three on YouTube as well. I am looking forward to the next installment. I don't know what that next installment is going to be, but I have my feelers out. There's some people I'm talking to. Talks are underway, negotiations are underway, but there should be some more. But today is just kind of a little bit of a rant, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Pen America, and thank you, Suzanne Nossel. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being intellectually honest in front of a wide audience like what reads the New York Times. That's the episode title of this podcast. Thank you, Pen America. Thank you, Suzanne Nossel. That's it. That's the title. That's the whole tweet. See you next week. No, I'm kidding. What am I on about? Well, the other night, Pen America held its annual gala at the Museum of Natural History. Well, I guess a little more than a week now at this point, where they rightfully awarded its Freedom of Expression Prize to Salman Rushdie, who actually made a personal appearance. Rushdie, as you know, was attacked on stage last August by a crazed, knife-wielding fundamentalist, and he nearly died from the attack. He has lost vision in one eye, but he cowboyed up the other night, and made a personal appearance at the gala. One of his first public appearances, I think, since the attack. I cannot tell you how much respect and admiration I have for that artist, not only because of his courage, but, I mean, his books are just phenomenal. If you haven't read The Moor's Last Sigh, go out and get it. That has to be one of my favorite books of all time. So it was nice to see Salman Rushdie back in action, back up on the stage, defiant as ever, brilliant as ever. It was nice to see that. And before the gala happened, Chief Executive of Pen America, Suzanne Nossel, spoke to the New York Times about the importance of the event as a flagship space to talk about free expression and free speech, both overseas and here in the United States. And when she talked about free speech, she was deliberate, very deliberate about talking about it as a value. Right now, what does that mean? Well, it means beyond the ink and paper boundaries of what's written in the U.S. Constitution in the First Amendment. Now, that's an important distinction because in recent years, there's been this really cute, very clever, rhetorical attempt on the part of certain people, mostly on Twitter, to basically say, well, so long as the government isn't abridging your speech, any other attempts to silence expression, to censor foul or offensive language, or to remove the platforms from speakers, that's just open and fair game, right? As long as it's not the government that's coming after you, then it's not censorship, right? And in some ways, you know, technically speaking, it is correct, right? It sort of has the rhetorical advantage of being correct. Yeah, technically, censorship is a government imposition. Right, a government abridgment of free speech, but that's not what we're talking about. That's not what Suzanne. She made this very broad statement about the value of free speech. Right, the principle behind free speech, not just the constitutional definition of free speech and free expression, or the sort of dictionary definition of censorship. They're very good with dictionaries when they want to be. I'm going to put a link in the show notes, but I would direct you to look at this obnoxious, entitled, presumptuous cartoon these censorious people love to drag out every time this issue comes up. And I've talked about this in the past. I think I've written about it in Substack. I don't know if I've talked about it on the podcast. But it's the one where the stick figure is talking to you, basically the audience, and the stick figure says the opposite. Says the opposite. Says the following. I'll read it to you. It says public service announcement, the first frame, right? The right to free speech means the government can't arrest you for what you say. Next frame. It doesn't mean that anyone else has to listen to your bullshit or host you while you share it. Okay, that's true. The First Amendment doesn't shield you from criticism or consequences. The fourth frame. If you're yelled at, boycotted, have your show canceled, or get banned from an internet community, your free speech rights aren't being violated. Nonsense. Fifth frame says, it's just that the people listening think you're an asshole. And then the last frame says, and they're showing you the door. And there's a picture of a door. Now, No indication in that cartoon about why you are the one who has to be shown the door and not the people who think you're an asshole. You know, doors work for everybody. Just in case you're curious about that. Why do I have to leave? Because you're the one with the problem. You go out the door if you're showing me the door. Show yourself the door. Why do we always have to be shown the door? Not that I ever said anything that offensive or that has caused this kind of a problem. But it's a really obnoxious cartoon because, yes, if you yelled at, boycotted, okay, if you yelled at, I understand, that's just life. You know, if you put yourself out in the public eye, you're going to run the risk of getting yelled at. You might even run the risk of getting boycotted. But getting banned from an internet community, getting banned from finding people who go to your advertisers, let's say you're big enough where you get an audience and people go around to your advertisers and threaten your advertisers or threaten the venues that are hosting you, right? And then they get nervous and they withdraw their invitation or they cancel the event on you. I'm sorry, that is violating free speech. It's not violating your First Amendment. You're correct. We're correct about that. It's not a First Amendment right to perform your poetry in a theater. But you are violating the principles of free speech when you do something like that. Ugh, such an obnoxious cartoon. Now I'm applauding PEN America because they seem like the only organization that, you know, while they might make mistakes in judgment, you know, at least they stick to their principles. And when a bunch of writers withdrew from the gala in 2015 over PEN's decision to give the French magazine Charlie Hebdo their Freedom of Expression Courage Award, PEN America stuck to its guns. Right. The writers who withdrew believed the award. They were annoyed. They thought the award shouldn't have been given to the Hebdo writers and the cartoonists who got massacred, by the way, in their office by psychotic, censorious gunmen, gunned down in cold blood. Brutal massacre. They shouldn't have gotten the award because Charlie Hebdo put out material that was offensive to the Muslim community. And Salman Rushdie had the tweet of the century, by the way, in response. And he wrote, if Penn as a free speech organization, this is a quote from him, quote, if Penn as a free speech organization can't defend and celebrate people who have been murdered for drawing pictures, then frankly, the organization is not worth the name. End quote. He said that in an interview. He was at one point, Salman Rushdie was actually the chief executive of PEN America for a few years. Then he tweeted when people were still kind of withdrawing from the gala and people were writing letters, open letters, encouraging other people to withdraw from the gala. He tweeted, the award will be given. Penn is holding firm. Just six pussies. Six authors in search of a bit of character. End quote. Love that man. So this year they honored Rushdie as well as two Iranian authors who have been jailed for their criticism of the regime. But it's the what Suzanne Nossel told the Times about free speech right here in the United States that drew all sorts of criticism from the usual suspects on Twitter. To quote from the Times article, this is the thing everybody took issue with. It really, the Times article itself actually focused on the fact that Rushdie had showed up to the event as his first public appearance since being attacked. But the quote that people took issue with is this, the author of the article in the Times wrote, quote, but PEN America has also steered its way through increasingly pitched battles over the value of free speech itself. Free speech, in scare quotes, has become a rallying cry for many conservatives, including those imposing book bans. At the same time, some progressives, including younger ones, dismiss, scare quotes, free speech, as a tool of the powerful and support calls to deplatform speakers and works they find offensive. And then they quote from Suzanne Nossel. She speaks to them. She said, we see free speech threatened on all sides, from the left and the right. Suzanne Nossel, who's been PEN America's chief executive since 2013, said in an interview before the gala, quote, people question it. They don't believe in it. They doubt it. But this is a really important time to shore it up as a cultural and constitutional value. That's part of what the gala does. End quote. Yes. Free speech is not just a constitutional right. It's a value. And because it's a value, it's something that can be violated or attacked from any side of the political spectrum. But no, this is apparently both sides-ing the issue. One of my favorites, and a fan of this podcast, Maris Kreitzman, simply tweeted no, quote, in response to the paragraph from the Times that I actually just read to you. She would later follow up by saying, which side is banning books? end quote, which is a very common rhetorical trick I often hear from people who like to argue that there's just absolutely, positively, absolutely no censorship issue coming from the left because the right is banning books. Can we please play another record? The right is always banning books. Allen Ginsberg was put on trial by forces of the right. Lenny Bruce was driven to an early grave by forces of the right. You can't just say the right is banning books for 50 years and then look the other way when the left comes along with their own version of book burning. We know the right is bad when it comes to issues of free speech. They always have been. That's why I could never, ever be in their camp. Where does Maris Kreitzman and her followers on Twitter think Suzanne Nossel's coming from? The right side of the political spectrum? Please. She's on the left, and she sees what's happening on the left, and she's calling it out. Are we not allowed to be critical of the left? I mean, strike that. We can be critical of the left when they're not left enough, or when they don't just spend every waking minute trashing the right. Then, you know, then we could be critical of them. One of her replies on Twitter was from a woman who actually stated, "I really, really, really would like to see some examples." And then someone on that tweet actually replied in an anonymous account, and I thanked them for that. Because you want some examples? Well, here we go. Alberto Gulaba Jr. When Alberto Gulaba Jr. wrote his debut novel, University Thugs, his agent went absolutely bonkers over it. He had publishers already on the line waiting to see his manuscript. And it was actually just days away from being sent out when his agent, whom he'd actually never met in person, told him that he should leverage his race and his ethnicity to help pitch the book. "Oh, I'm not black," Gulaba replied. "I'm actually Filipino." "Oh," his agent said. And then started a whirlwind of revisions, sensitivity readers, recommendations for Gulaba to change all of his black characters, including the main character, into a Filipino one. By the time he was done with the revisions, he was basically like, "Can you just make every character here Filipino?" And the agent, look, he knew that he was going to run into all sorts of trouble if he helped publish a Filipino writer telling a story with a black character. It wasn't hashtag own voices, right? Gulaba and the agent eventually parted ways, and Gulaba ends up self-publishing University Thugs under a pseudonym on Amazon's self-publishing platform. How about another one? How about Kosako Jackson? This is actually a case that reminded me of that Spider-Man meme where there are two Spider-Men pointing at each other, because Kosako Jackson was actually an online snitch himself. He participated in all sorts of pylons for young adult fiction. Lunatics, right? Who went basically, who want to line every work of fiction with emotional bubble wrap, right? And trigger warning everything. So he went after writers for promoting what he thought were harmful tropes or harmful stereotypes. He went after writers again for not being hashtag own voices. And then one day they came for him, and he'd written a young adult novel about two young gay teenagers finding each other against the backdrop of the ethnic cleansing atrocities in Kosovo in the early 1990s. And people got up in arms about it. They thought it was centering the wrong story, erasing the history of the many people who died in the Kosovo wars. And he ended up withdrawing his novel from publication just months before it was about to hit the shelves, with a lot of anticipation as well. How about Emily Wen Zhao, right? One of Zhao's primary critics was actually Kosako Jackson, who joined in on a Twitter mob to go after this Chinese immigrant for her novel Blood Air. Right? That was also due to be released with great acclaim, to great hype. And they went after it and pressured her to pull the book from publication. Why? Because in this fantasy young adult novel, a minority of magical creatures are enslaved by an oppressive majority. And critics thought it was minimizing the black experience in America, despite the fact that this was a fantasy novel. It was set in a far-off planet and written by a Chinese national. So, in other words, absolutely nothing to do with America's painful history of slavery. Right? Writing the word slavery or having slaves in your book does not necessarily denote or even imply the American slave trade. Plenty of civilizations had slaves. And again, the setting of this novel was a different planet, presumably with no knowledge of planet Earth, let alone America. Emily Wen Zhao ended up having to pull her book. She withdrew it. I think eventually she re-released it after reworking it. But Jesus, in poetry, you've got Michael Dickman. I've mentioned the Michael Dickman scandal plenty of times. You can go back to some of my earlier podcasts on sensitivity readers, and I think I even brought him up during my series on John Gardner. Dickman has published a poem, or had published a poem in Poetry Magazine called Shawls Ferry Road. And in the poem, the speaker of the poem is reflecting on the, I guess you'd call it a complicated legacy of his dead grandmother, who was, you know, in the poem both kind-hearted, but also, you know, held some pretty ugly prejudices, particularly against Asian people, Pacific Island people. And in the poem, the speaker mentions that the grandmother directed him to drive over, to basically run over a group of Pacific Islanders who were crossing the street. They were in the crosswalk. And I believe also in the poem, the grandmother used a racial slur. So naturally, a Twitter storm brewed over the next couple days, spurned on by actually a young Asian woman who basically said, "Why is Poetry Magazine publishing this?" In the fallout of all this, Shawls Ferry Road got pulled from Poetry's online edition. It basically got memory holed. And the magazine's poetry editor was forced to resign from his job because he published a poem that he thought was essentially an ode to a complicated relationship with a complicated person. Janine Cummins is another example. This is a well-worn story, but for those of the uninitiated among you, Janine Cummins is the author of American Dirt, which is a novel about a Mexican woman and her son who escaped north to the U.S. after her journalist husband is gunned down by the local cartel. Now, her case is an interesting one, actually, because the early negativity surrounding that novel, I actually thought was fair game. I read all the critiques of her novel, and I thought they were fascinating to read, and they raised some really interesting points. Mexican and Mexican-American writers came forward to critique the novel, and they pointed out a lot of inaccuracies in the novel, you know, sections that kind of struck a false tone or smacked of inauthenticity. The book's main critic, a woman named Miriam Gerba, spelled out a host of examples that made the book basically feel like it was written by a white tourist who read some headlines about Mexico and then spent a week in Cancun to do research, right? So I thought the criticism of the book was actually well-founded. You know, it was not unfair. It was perfectly fair to call out what they saw as inaccuracies and inauthenticity in the book. But the reaction to what should be done about it was not fair. It was not rational. People went after her backstory. They tweeted about her upcoming book release party. They hounded independent bookstores for carrying the title on its shelves. Look, you know, in the end, American Dirt is still on the shelves at just about any Target or Walmart, right? And Janine made her money, and Oprah gave her a big Cigna boost. But her book tour was canceled after a rash of violent threats against her, her publisher, the venues that were planning to host her, other writers who agreed to interview her in panel discussions. That's a bit much. The question in this case isn't whether Cummins suffered personally or professionally or whether she was quote-unquote censored. But think about this. How many budding writers, how many unpublished writers or newly published writers watched what went on, looked at their work in progress, and slowly backed away? These are the ways in which free speech can be threatened from the left. Do you want some more? More examples? Kate Clancy. I talked about her as well in a previous podcast. Another well-documented case. Her memoir, Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me, chronicles Clancy's many years of teaching experience at a diverse public school in England. And the critics of her book took issue with how she depicted many of her students of color, her autistic students, working-class students. So what they did was they wrote their own book where they properly described their own students in the manner in which they should be described. No, of course they did not do that. What they did instead was they hounded Clancy and her publisher, Picador, until they decided to employ a team of sensitivity readers to pore over her manuscript for the transgressions that were called out, as well as any new transgressions that they happened to discover as they were reading through the second time. So, for example, the sensitivity readers took issue with how she counseled a gay student she had driven to a nightclub to be careful about the AIDS epidemic, which was in the early 90s. Eventually, Clancy and Picador actually parted ways, and the ordeal absolutely turned Clancy's life upside down. And this was all during their conversation on the reprint, not the initial print run. Fortunately, she managed to sort of sneak the initial print run past these people. But the second time around, she was not so lucky. It became a big, complicated mess. How about Chandler Morrison? Did you ever hear of Chandler Morrison? All right, this is a fiction writer, and he had the audacity, the absolute gall, the temerity to gross people out at a gross-out contest. I'm not kidding. In 2019, Morrison attended BizarroCon, which is a conference for horror and suspense writers. It was in Portland, Oregon. The conference hosts every year an event called the Ultimate Bizarro Showdown, which is essentially a gross-out contest, but also can include performances that are kind of just weird and avant-garde and out of context. You know, as an example, during that same event, there was a guy in the contest who dressed up in a green bodysuit and painted his face green, and he sang Rainbow Connection in a Kermit the Frog voice. So that kind of stuff goes on at this Ultimate Bizarro Showdown, right? It's not entirely a gross-out contest. Some people have taken an issue with that characterization. But there were definitely people out there who were doing sort of offensive, transgressive, gross-out stuff. Morrison went the gross-out route. And choosing to convey a story that involved having sex with an aborted fetus, he used a baby doll, a dildo, and some fake blood as a prop. And some people actually in the audience claim that the fake blood was actually brown paint to make the aborted fetus a person of color, but Morrison denies this. Okay, not my style. Not something I would do or really want to be in the audience for. But by the time Morrison walked out of the building, he had not only gotten himself banned from future Bizarro Cons, he also lost his book contract. I tried to get Morrison on here to talk about this particular experience, but he declined to be interviewed. In the aftermath of the controversy, there was an author kind of stood up for her, Monica J. O'Rourke. She said, quote, "Censorship is censorship regardless of the topic." It's exactly what I'm talking about. Censorship is censorship, regardless of the topic, she said. This was about feelings and sensibilities being hurt in a venue where people could have walked out. By the way, some of the people in that thread complaining the loudest about that performance, either one, weren't even in the room during the event, or two, congratulated the author at the end of his performance. Suddenly, they're all offended. And in another juicy bit of irony, these same people decrying censorship are calling for the author to be banned from future conventions and are even trying to get his book pulled. Well, they actually succeeded in getting his book pulled, Monica. She actually didn't realize that at the time that she provided that quote, but they did succeed in getting his book pulled. And that's exactly the crux of my argument as well right now. You can't decry book banning from the right and then look the other way when other forms of silencing, such as deplatforming and boycotts and intimidation, are being employed by your own people on the left. That's called having no ethics. Roald Dahl. I spoke about this too on a previous podcast, but Roald Dahl's books have been bowdlerized by an agency that rents out sensitivity readers. The sensitivity readers offered revisions and rewrites to his original work on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Witches because it included what they deemed harmful language and harmful imagery. And this is straight up putting a fig leaf over Michelangelo's David. That's all this is. And it's coming from the left, not the right. Now, to be fair, Maris Kreitzman, I mentioned earlier, she actually publicly denounced the move, but I find it a little hard to stomach considering her and her ilk have contributed to the climate that makes something like this even a remote possibility. The tweets that she puts out, the aura she puts out about what we should tolerate from writers and what we shouldn't, breeds this kind of ground. Mark Twain, years ago, publishers reissued Twain's classics, Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, to remove the racially insensitive slurs that Twain included in the book. Anesthetizing the original work of a genius is a form of censorship. I'm sorry. It doesn't matter if you're doing it with the best of intentions. I understand why you're doing it, but you're still doing it nonetheless. That's just a few examples, right, that I pulled from my own memory. As I was thinking about this and I was writing this, preparing this podcast, I'm sure there are plenty of others. And if there are others, feel free to email me, MatthewMcGevin@gmail.com, and I can include them and update this. All right, but those are just the ones that I could think off the top of my head. Now, is book banning a bad thing? Of course it is. And I don't make any excuses for the right-wing knuckle-draggers like Ron DeSantis who are doing this stuff in their states. As far as I'm concerned, As far as I'm concerned, after Hitler burned books in the 1930s, we shouldn't be banning anything. I can't believe there's even such a thing as a banned books list in 2023. Not to mention the fact that the right spends all this time preoccupied with making sure kids aren't reading immoral books. They have nothing to say about the fact that kids aren't reading. Period. That's a bigger problem. But let me tell you why I think the censorious left is actually in some ways worse than the censorious right in this current era. This is crazy, right? I know, both sizing. Ugh. Right? At least, with a good old-fashioned, Bible-thumping, uptight, book-banning mission from the right, you see them coming. And let's be honest, with the Streisand effect and everything, right? The Streisand effect, the idea that if somebody tells you not to read something, you're going to go out and read it immediately. It actually boosts sales when books get banned. Most authors would welcome a good old-fashioned, Bible-thumping, uptight book banning. Most writers are on the left, let's be fair, and they would love nothing more than to get into a public spat with a mouth breather like Ron DeSantis or Tucker Carlson. But take that same left-leaning writer, that same writer from the left, get her into a public spat with someone on the left, someone like Maris Kreitzman or Kosako Jackson, and all of a sudden it's a different ballgame. They're stressing, they're apologizing, they're deleting their social media accounts. The grief you get from your own people is far, far worse than the grief that you get from your enemies. I'm not both sidesing. Suzanne Nossel isn't both sidesing. We just expect the right to act like pearl-clutching, censorious twats. We don't expect people on the left to act that way, but here we are. And all I'm asking for is a little honesty. All I'm asking is that people acknowledge that censorship can happen when writers are too scared to take risks, to touch on third-rail social issues, to write moral fiction, because they'll catch all kinds of heat from their own tribe. I'm not worried about Roald Dahl, per se. He's dead. His troubles are over. I'm worried about the 100 writers called not Roald Dahl, who see what can happen when the left gets its hands on a dead guy's work and decides, you know, rather than forging ahead to chase their ideas down the alleyway, they'll just turn back and retreat to safety, which is the death of literature, which is the death of art. And it would be nice if some of our public intellectuals on the left who have influence and who have access to mainstream media platforms like the New York Review of Books to show a little bit of honesty about the chilling effect these deplatformings and book contract cancelings can have on up-and-coming writers, on unknown writers. But instead, no, we get that dumb cartoon. They're just showing us the door. So, yeah, I'm taking the time this week to applaud Suzanne Nossel and to applaud PEN America and to also applaud the few of us who agree with Nossel on this issue. I see you. You're out there. I see the subset of people who are out there. Don't let yourself get gaslit by these people. The pressure to conform comes from all directions, folks. The only move is to keep writing. Just keep on writing. Once more to the breach, dear friends. Eventually the line will break. It has to. Art leads, right? It never follows. And that's my rant. Thank you for listening to my rant. I had to get it off my chest. Keep checking back on this podcast. As I said, I'm going to be doing some more craft series stuff. It's called The Ink Drop. Subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Help me stay motivated to keep this going. And I'm going to see you all in the near future. Again, this is The Ink Drop. I'm Matthew McGivna, and you take care. Hellcat.